All right.
Welcome to the Athletic NBA Show, Monday through Friday,
on the Athletic Podcast Network.
It is another edition of Hoops Adjacent on the Athletic NBA Show. I'm David Aldridge here in D.C. in the Bay, Marcus Thompson. What is up, man?
Yo, it's town biz out here. We in the sunny California D.A. Should I tell you how great the weather is?
No, please don't, because I'll...
It's a beautiful mix of breeze and sun. We in the streets... You know, we're posted up at the lake.
Barbecue. You can't barbecue because Becky will call the cops on you.
Right? Hey, Becky Ben got shut down. That's all we do now is barbecue. She just started something.
Just defying Becky, right?
in defiance of Becky, this is what we do. We post up at the lake. It is beautiful in California.
Damn. Well, you are joined in Cali by the Cali native, the Crenshaw High School graduate, the five-time NBA All-Star, our guest this week, the Bucks. TV analyst Marcus Johnson. Marcus, man, it is so good to have you. Thank you for joining us. You in LA?
Yes, I am, editor in chief. What's up? That's all I've been reading about, man. You big time.
I need that HNIC hat. You know what I'm saying?
It's all good, man. That's the one to get. You got it, too.
You know what I'm saying? So.
Congratulations, brother. You are well deserved.
Thank you, man.
Yes, I am in LA.
Man, that's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing, man. I'm never going to argue with it because the weather's so nice out there, man. I can't argue with it. You know, that's why people like to live in LA. Yeah. I get it.
So we just do the first round of the playoffs, and our final game was when Saturday against Miami. I had my reservations made for 5 p.m. Saturday afternoon.
You were messing around.
You know, everybody's like, man, that's bad. That's superstitious, man. That's bad karma. I was like, no, man. I gotta change it, I'll change it. But if we win, I want to get out of here and get back to some sunshine. It was raining. It was about 45 degrees at the end of May in Milwaukee. And I was ready to get up and get on, man. So it worked out beautifully.
That's the OG move right there. That's smart.
I bet it. You know, because it always happens where, you know, something will happen like that. Then I got to scramble at the last minute to get a flight reservation. You know what I mean? It's a big scramble. I was like, let me go ahead and just, you know, if we lose, I'll just – you know, I'll just go ahead and make the adjustment for whenever Wednesday the next week. But hey, we won and everything worked out beautifully. So,
man, yeah. I want to ask you real quick before we get into the whole playoffs and the Bucks and everything and all that you've been doing. So that was your last game with Jim Paschke, who's the legendary play-by-play guy with the Bucks, right?
Man, at 35 years, he's been doing Bucks basketball and. That was it. That was the last game of his Bucks broadcasting career. And we had a great time over this 6-year run, DA, and just knowledgeable as anybody, you know, in his role as a play-by-play guy. And our best conversations were really, you know, off air, you know, just the stuff we talk about. He's 69, I'm 65. So similar point references in terms of what we went through in the 60s and the 70s and all that good stuff. So I'm going to miss him, man, and true professional and one of the best in the game in terms of what he does. So, yeah, that was his last game.
And that's quite a career. Quite a career.
Yes,
indeed. That's incredible.
Yeah, so, and you know, it's funny. It was said to me and Kevin Calabro years ago about how a local gig is sometimes better than a sporadic national gig. Now, if you got a great, solid national gig, it's one thing, but that good local gig is something to be coveted. And Jim Paschke, he definitely proved that. And, you know, I've learned that over the years. I've had my flirtations on the national level, but and you get you a good, solid local gig like that, you know, it's just worth its weight in gold. And so those things are great to come about. And Jim Paschke was one of those local legends in Wisconsin that Wisconsin's had some great broadcasters through the years. And he goes on that list of just legendary kind of Wisconsin broadcasters.
Go ahead, Marcus.
There's something like, so, you know, as a dude, like, you know, loyal to the Bay and like, you know, got roots here. There's something just special about that. Like when you can just plant yourself and be comfortable. You ain't chasing, you know, you're not like out here trying to, the grass ain't always greener. You can really invest it. There's just something really special about that for me, that's foundational to sports is local, right?
And so, Marcus, for me, growing up in L.A., so check this out. So I'm a kid of the 60s here. So I grew up with Vin Scully doing the Dodgers, Chick Hearn, you know, doing the Lakers. Dick Enberg was the UCLA guy in the late 60s, early 70s when I first got there. When Dick moved up to the national level, Al Michaels took over as the UCLA guy for a year or two. Wow. You know, so but just being able to have that kind of exposure to that level of local broadcasting. But the bigger point being, and you know this too, both you guys, I mean, you grew up with these guys. And so Jim Paschke has that kind of following of people. Steve Novak, who does our games as a color analyst alongside myself, he talked about you listening to Jim since he's 5, 6, 7 years old. You know what I mean? So you think about that in that context. You grew up with these people, the familiarity, they become like family. You know, you go through their ups and downs, the team's ups and downs, and it becomes a whole thing, man, that's a whole connection that I don't think people understand just how deep that thing cuts. And so it is special.
No question, man. I mean, you mentioned Calabro. I've known Kevin for a long time, but I always connect Kevin to the Supersonics. You know what I mean? Talking about the Rain Man and talking about Peyton and same thing with Kevin Harlan, who's been great on TNT for years, but I still think of him as the Wolves, Timberwolves guy, you know, with KG back in the day. So yeah, the local thing, man.
Yeah.
It has
the big ticket.
Exactly, right.
And the
right.
glove and all. Yeah, no, it's and I had the good fortune of working with Kevin Calabro during the mid 90s when the Sonics were really good with George Karl, the Bulls in the finals in 96 or whenever that was, Michael Jordan's championship, Father's Day, hugging the trophy. So during that string, I mean, it was just incredible, and people still will recall fondly. I just had a request today to do a local radio show up in Seattle because the Thursday is the 25th anniversary of the Game 7 against Utah. So they want to do a whole show, you know, in Seattle.
It's 25 years? Is that right? Yeah. Oh, my God. I was at that game. Jesus.
That is crazy. Wow. But yeah, so it's all good. Yeah.
That's crazy. Wow. 25 years. Where did the time go? It seems like that was yesterday. Yep. Oh man, I had so much fun in Seattle. That's a whole show in and of itself, man. Let's talk about the Bucks, though, man. They took care of business with the sweep of Miami, got you home quickly, you know. And the defense, man, like the defensive rating is insane. It was 95 per game, which is like that sounds like something from 1986. You know what I mean? And you know, as a result, they were able to just kind of dominate that series. What was the biggest takeaway from you from those four games with them?
Well, there was quite a bit, but I guess the biggest was the importance of playing your best player on your opponent's best player. You got the defensive player of the year in Giannis Antetokounmpo. Last year, I'm not sure if he guarded Jimmy Butler more than 5 possessions in that 5-game loss to the Heat down in the bubble. And give Coach Budenholzer some credit in terms of growth and learning and stretching, you know, his philosophy. He went by this corporate knowledge kind of philosophy where, you know, you don't change things unless there's some drastic need to. And you could say that the Bucks in the last couple of playoffs against Toronto 2 years ago, Miami last year, I mean, was the call for some drastic changes. But he really made an effort this year to kind of change his whole approach defensively. And for us, for the Bucks, I say us, but you know, I'm part of the organization. But I know it's a broadcasting no-no. But for us, for the Bucks, it was putting Giannis on Jimmy Butler. And you look at Butler's numbers, you know, he didn't average as many points, I think 15 or just under 15, as Bryn Forbes did for us. His shooting percentages were way down. He worked and struggled for everything he got. And a lot of that was just, you know, Giannis is so good in terms of weak side off ball rim protection. But even against Butler on ball, when Butler would get by him, Butler had this awareness of Giannis's presence trailing him, and it impacted everything he did. And I just think Jimmy Butler never got comfortable. He killed us last year. He averaged almost 24 a game and just diced us up 40 points in game 1 last year to set the tone. It was a totally different story this year. And I think it starts it starts with Giannis on Butler. But then, you know, Brook Lopez, he'd been criticized and knocked around publicly in the media because of his inability at times to contain smaller players. Chris Paul, Devin Booker come to mind in particular down in Phoenix when they gave him a lot of trouble. But they give everybody, every big man on a switch like that trouble.
Yeah.
But Brook's focus and his footwork and everything that he did defensively was just on a whole nother level, and was a problem with his size overwhelming the Heat when they would start Bam on Giannis. Now he's matched up against Trevor Ariza, and he just overwhelmed them with his size. So it was a lot of good things defensively, man. But I think it starts with Giannis, and then you always got to throw Drew Holiday in the mix because of his it was overall tenacity. Let me just put it that way. You know, between PJ Tucker, Drew Holiday, the tenacity of this team has increased exponentially since last year. And in the playoffs, as you guys well know, that becomes really, really important.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, because one of the things that also stood out was, you know, Tyler Hero didn't get off. Duncan Robinson didn't get off. And this team that kind of lived by knocking down threes, they had a hand in their face every time. And it felt like Drew was the spearhead of that. But the perimeter defense felt like it was like, yo, it's game time. They were slapping the floor. They had the shorts hiked up. Like, it felt like they were ready. Did you get that same vibe?
Well, see, that when you said that, you know, I go back to my DC imagery of Georgetown with Gene Smith and Michael Jackson as the two guards. You talk about slap. Gene Smith was the four slapping his brother I ever seen in my life. And, you know, his name kind of gets lost, you know, in the annals of kind of great defensive players. But you know what I'm talking about, dude. He would get down and just and so that's correct, Marcus, in terms of the mindset. And I really believe that the addition of PJ Tucker in March to this team, not only as a great communicator defensively, calling out whatever's schemes and switches, but just getting into the heads of these guys on the sideline. And he's always talking. And Pat Connaughton talked about that in one of our media availability sessions, about how he's always in his ear on situations and what should be done here, what should be done there. And also Pat Connaughton talked about watching PJ defend bigger players in the post and how he gets down low and how he puts that forearm in their back and he doesn't give up position, and how you see PJ do it and it challenges you as a defensive player to do the same thing. So Pat Connaughton played this kind of defense against Jeff Green the last two games against Brooklyn of the regular season. He got down and played as physically and as aggressively in the post as I've ever seen him. And he says that was the direct correlation to being around PJ Tucker. So, you know, not enough can be said about that kind of mindset. And then you talked about Duncan Robinson. He burned us. I mean, Eric Spoelstra, one of my favorites, he went at Chris Middleton guarding Duncan Robinson in game one. Duncan finished, I think, with 25, 7 threes. He was killing Chris. Chris made the adjustments. And the biggest adjustment was just exerting more energy, fighting through screens and being a little cuter in terms of, you know, keeping it, locking him in from going one direction, forcing him out one particular direction to cut down his options. But again, energy exertion and making sure you're contesting everything and you're right in the guy's face and making the guy aware of you every time he comes around the screen. You're right there trailing in his tracks, attached to him. And that was a big deal. And after game one, that kind of changed everything around, and you didn't hear nary a peep out of Duncan Robinson or pretty much Tyler Hero the rest of that series.
Man, see, this is I've been talking about this really for a few weeks now, Marcus, is that I believe that the Bucks, because of Jrue and PJ.
Oh, yes, he has. Trust me on this.
I'm not just saying this. Okay. I think they are the one team that is built to beat Brooklyn in the playoffs because they can slap PJ on Harden, they can put Jrue on Kyrie Irving, they can put Giannis on KD, and as I continually say, I'm not saying they're going to stop those guys, but I'm saying those three can make those dudes work better than any other three that anybody else has in the league.
Yeah, and the one thing you look at, when you look at, you know, advanced analytics, and I'm all about kind of, you know, what's going on out of the court situationally, but both Harden, KD are more turnover prone than what you would imagine, especially KD. You're looking at his numbers. And the other point, PJ Tucker, our analytics department provided us with the breakdown on him. he's actually guarded both KD and LeBron in terms of their effective field goal percentage when he's matched up against them. He's the best in the league over the last 3 years with a certain amount of possessions of defending both those guys. Now, as you mentioned,
PJ Tucker gives KD problems. Like, I remember that in the finals.
You're not going to stop him, but you're going to make him work. You're going to try and get in their head a little bit. And instead of him, this is my thing, instead of KD on a day where he may go off for 45, you hold him to 33. You know what I'm saying?
Right. I mean, so
you look at
30.
Yes. You look at 33, and you're like, "Oh, he lit him up." Well, no, that was a day against anybody else. He's gonna get 45, maybe 50.
Right.
But you're holding him to 30. You know, you're doing a really great defensive job that doesn't appear to be great on paper. But PJ Tucker is that kind of a guy.
Yeah. No. Exactly. And that's why I just think, and that allows Middleton to kind of roam around. You can put him on Harris. You know what I mean? Like, you can do different things with him. And it just gives you more options. So I just feel like Milwaukee's going to, and I'm assuming Brooklyn's going to win that series, that it's going to be a hell of a series. But the issue for Milwaukee and for Brooklyn, to me, is that they got to play each other. Whereas Philly, they'll one way or another end the series with Washington pretty quick. And then, you know, they'll probably get Atlanta second round. And all due respect to Atlanta, I think.
Don't you start dissing Trae Young, D.A.
I just think Philly got that length, man. They're just long as hell. I think they get to the conference finals a little easier than either Milwaukee or Brooklyn can get to the conference finals.
Yeah, no, without question. And I mean, I will give Nate McMillan, talk about old Sonics, the job that he has done, the way he's got these guys playing. And this Hunter kid, RJ Hunter, Hunter from Virginia.
He
gives them another lengthy shooter athlete that just makes them a little bit more problematic. But I agree with you just in terms of what Philly can trot out there with Doc Rivers' experience in terms of getting those types of teams ready to play. If Embiid is healthy, and that's he came out of the game the other night.
Right.
If he's healthy, it's going to be tough for the Hawks to contend with him. But on the other side, I mean, look, you know, it's obviously going to be a major monumental task to beat Brooklyn, but I like our coaching advantage. You know, Steve Nash, even though he's got some great assistants, you know, in his ear on the bench, but just coming out with enough of wrinkles defensively to throw at them, where you get them out of rhythm and maybe steal a game or two early or whatever. You know how these things go, but it's just going to be, I think, a great series just in terms of kind of the X's and O's and schemes and all that. But the bottom line is you got to deal with these three Hall of Fame
crazy,
level,
and
Joe Harris.
And Blake
Griffin, who is still,
right,
Blake
right.
is still serviceable. He can still, he can hurt you in sporadic kind of minor situations. So it's going to be a test, man. It'll be the ultimate test. But if we can get by, Brooklyn, the sky's going to be the limit, because it will be filled with so much confidence going into, finals against the Sixers. So anyway, but getting by Brooklyn is going to be tough.
Of course, you know this feeling, this exact feeling the Bucks will be going through, right? Because what was it? What was it, 82, 83, maybe 84, playing them Celtics? Felt like they had 59.
And the Sixers, right?
All the above. And so – I forget the year, maybe 83. I forget exactly the year, but three teams won 60 games. The Celtics won 62. Philly won 62. We won 60. And we were really even with the Sixers until they signed Moses Malone. And
that just that seems unfair.
That just threw off everything. Man. And it was embarrassing in terms of just how good they were once they picked up Moses Malone. But we played until a seventh game. In a conference finals or semi a year or two prior to that, and then kind of battled them really, really closely. The Celtics caught them that one year when we swept them, and then they came back the next year and kind of dominated over the next 4 or 5 years in the mid to late 80s before the Pistons kind of got going. But yeah, I mean, we were always looking, and so it was a feeling at the time of just abject failure, not getting to the finals, because I just knew in my heart of hearts, the deepest in my soul, that we would get to the finals and have a chance to compete for a championship. And to not do it, you just felt this feeling of failure. But then you you know, you have the benefit of hindsight. You look back on these Celtic teams and all the Hall of Famers on their front line, plus DJ and all the Hall of Famers coming out of Philly, plus Mo Cheeks in the backcourt, Doc and Bobby Jones and Moses, you know, that whole Carwell Jones, one of the most underrated defenders in the history of the league, who I had to go against, you know, at the defensive end of the floor, him and Bobby Jones, and I had to guard Doc at the offensive end. So it was like working overtime. So, you know, it's nothing to, looking back on it, my point is it's nothing to hang your head about. I mean, you lost to some great teams, and that's just kind of how it is.
No question. And I always use those Bucks teams as kind of the template for what, you know, smaller market teams should aspire to be. You know what I mean? Like the right. Bucks teams, and I can't remember. I know I looked this up at one point. But those teams during that decade of the 80s, I think that y'all won the second most games in the league for the whole decade. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. So it was always a 50-win team. It was never, you know, y'all never really dropped off all that much. And I tell people all the time, you just don't know how good they were, how good that Milwaukee team was. Like, they were really good, you know? So it's unfortunate that you couldn't break through, but it's explainable. You know what I mean? So,
yeah.
And here's the other thing, Marcus, I went back and looked, I have this idea, and maybe it's cause I was a kid back then, but I always thought of you as this kind of 6'8", 6'9" power forward, living at the elbows, making jumpers, man, you were handling the ball a lot. You had the rock in your hands a lot. You were a playmaker as well as a scorer.
Cali, that's why. That's how we do it.
I got you. Let's go. Man, yeah, I mean, you had the, obviously the complete game, but how did that come about when you got to Milwaukee? You know, when you have other great players on that team, Ricky Pierce and some other guys that were really, really good scorers. How did the ball, and Moncrief and all those guys, how did the ball wind up in your hands so much?
Well, here's the deal is that, and Ricky Pierce, we never played together. He was actually involved in the trade when I went to the Clippers.
Okay.
So Pierce, gotcha. Craig Hodges, Terry Cummings came to the Bucks. Me and Junior Bridgman, Harvey Ketchings went to the Clippers. So we never crossed paths. So, and he's a great, great player, especially that just, but we had a guy in Junior Bridgman who was similar just in terms of instant offense coming off the bench. But we played against the Nets. And Nelly would allow me to have a lot of freedom handling the basketball. But we played against the Nets around 84, I believe, in the playoffs. And they had Michael Ray Richardson. They had a great defensive guard by the name of Darwin Cook, also Crenshaw High School. And we had a lot of point guard injuries. I think Tiny Archibald had retired early and some other guys had gotten hurt. So it was Mike Dunleavy Sr., trying to bring the ball up against Michael Ray Richardson and Darwin Cook.
That didn't end well.
They were spinning him around right and left. And so before we lost game one, I believe. And so we went back to New Jersey, tied one all. And so before game three, Nelly at morning shoot around said to me that he wanted me to initiate the offense. So every play, if it's a high post UCLA cut, I'd bring the ball up the court against Buck Williams or Albert King, dribble to the wing, hit the high post, Sidney would cut off. So every play we designed for me to bring the ball up the floor. So after we walked through that, this is a true story, I said to Nelly, so instead of a point guard, I'm like a point forward. So he was like, oh, yeah, point forward. I like that. Yeah, you're my point forward.
Oh, my
so
God.
I was the first guy to utter that phrase.
Oh, don't tell me you created that word.
I was the guy too. The first guy to utter that phrase. And so in that series, there's some old footage I came across on YouTube. You know, you can see me handling the ball. We got Paul Pressey on the floor at times, but I'm still the guy bringing the ball to the floor. I got traded after that season. Paul Pressey was put into that position, and that's where, you know, he got kind of stuck with the point forward deal. But I always tell people, Paul was one of the greatest point guards in Missouri Valley Conference history at Tulsa. So the leap for him to play, you know, to be a great point guard in college, to be a point forward was not quite the same as my leap as just a forward all my life. Oh my, but the other thing, D.A., you talk about 6'8", 6'9". I mean, I'm like 6'6", you
that's
know,
I'm
listed at 6'7".
I have 6'9" in my head for you. I don't know why. It's crazy.
Yeah, well, you know, I played, cause I, you know, I was a good rebounder for my size.
Yeah.
Not on the Barkley kind of level, but my rookie year, I averaged like almost 20 and 10. And then it's funny, after I averaged 10 rebounds a game my rookie year, a couple of my teammates, Junior Brisbane, Brian Winters, are like, man, you don't need to average 10 rebounds. You need to give them about 7 or 8 rebounds a game the way you're playing right now, and that'll be enough. And you know, you're going to wear yourself like thin trying to average 10 rebounds a game. And so, you know, Junior Brisbane, how could you not take his advice as wise as he is? And I kind of scale that back. But anyway, but yeah, so that's how the ball handling and the point forward stuff kind of came about. And but yeah, it was he was the first Don Nelson back in those days to really kind of approach the game in that positionless basketball type of mindset. And so I would play the five. I would play the five and guard Daryl Dawkins. I remember specifically situations guarding Dawkins, guarding centers inside. We wouldn't do it for any great length of time, but for 5 minute spurts, just to change the dynamic of the game, we'd go real small and just push and rebound and shoot and, you know, run teams ragged. So it was a fun brand of basketball to play.
Spring is the best time to add new challenges to your training, just in time for summer and warmer days. I know I'm looking outside right now. Sun's out, birds are chirping. It's time to start getting outside. I know that I like to get outside and play basketball with my kids. And honestly, I need to get into a fitness routine in order to keep up with these guys. And Peloton is there for me. Peloton's varying class lengths were designed with your training plan in mind. Personalize your workout, whether you'd like to add a 10-minute core session at the end of your strength class, or take a 60-minute power zone ride to increase your endurance. Peloton classes are designed to help focus on your needs and goals. Peloton's classes were made to challenge you. There are a variety of classes like boot camps, boxing, full body strength, or marathon training, all created to grow your skills or push you to improve in what you're already excelling in. Peloton's program and instruction push you to be your best. Their expert coaches and nonstop vibes will push you to new levels of strength and endurance, keeping you on your toes while giving you the professional coaching you need. Peloton has everything you need to get you where you're going. Whether you prefer to run indoors, row or ride at home, or strength train at the gym, Peloton has something for you. Get your head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
You know what's interesting? You have an interesting perspective on this as the first ever point forward and a guy who kind of played both ways. We're watching this kind of clash of styles, especially like Bucks and Nets, right? It's like this perimeter orientation, or you know, is the return of the big man. And even in this series, you know, the Bucks series, Brook was down low, man. It was like Brook was like, all right, you guys are little. Let me get down in there. I know this is DA's thing, right? Like, he's huge. Get
Let
down
Brook
there.
Be a center.
Where do you fall in this? As one who's kind of in the middle, I guess we'll see it as it plays out. You got the three guys on the perimeter of Brooklyn, or the counter to that is the Joel Embiid, is the Milwaukee, is the team that could punish him inside. Where do you kind of fall in, I guess, the better way to play?
Well, first, let me correct some. I mean, I wasn't the first point forward. If you look at some old footage, Maurice Stokes, Rick Barry in the 75 championship series, he's averaging 7 assists. Robert Reed in the early 80s for Houston under Del Harris played the position when they had Alan Lovell and Mike Newland and these great shooters. Calvin Murphy, you know, coming off of screens. It was Robert Reed, Johnny Johnson. For Lenny Wilkins, but I was the first one to coin that phrase. So that's the only thing I claim. There were other forwards that there were other.
No, Rick Barry was nice too.
They better ball handlers, better passers, all that. I don't claim to be the template or the consummate point forward, but I was just the first one to utter that phrase. It's my only claim to fame. That's number one. Number two, your point about Brooke Lopez. It's funny when he came to us. 3 years ago, Budenholzer's first year, that's when he, and I forget the other shooting big man, but there were two of them that led the league in the number of attempts from deep threes. And those are three-pointers like 25 to 29 feet. And so he led the league in terms of bigs, in terms of shooting percentage and attempts for deep threes. Now his game is starting to slowly get closer to the basket. His post-ups in terms of post-up percentage, I forget the number, but he's posting up a lot more. Last year, I think 17% of his possessions last year were post-ups. This year, it's down to about 12 or 13%. He is so good, guys, at this, these I call them these unconventional shot put push shots in the key, the one-legged fadeaways. I mean, just these really, and this is by design. He and shooting coach Ben Sullivan, Ben Sullivan will actually kick him like a soccer style kick. He'll kick the ball. He'll kick past to Brook, which means Brook has got to catch the ball at all kinds of weird, crazy angles, and then just turn and immediately find the basket and shoot, square up and shoot. And I've been watching him do this for 3 years, and now I think we're starting to see kind of some of the shots that he's making is a direct result of that. But I believe that when you've got a guy like Brook Lopez, especially in, to answer your question, Marcus, especially in the playoffs, especially when the possessions get more limited, scoring, moving the scoreboard becomes more of a premium. You got a guy like Brook who can overpower smaller defenders, who can out-finesse bigger guys down in the low box. You got to use that. And that's one thing that Coach Budenholzer has understood these last couple of years. This year, more than ever, and against Miami, Brook was just, he was a monster down there because he's 7 feet, 280 and really skilled, great hands, great touch. You got to find a way to use that. And so I think that's one of the things that has helped improve this offense is that we're no longer just spotting him up for deep threes. Now take advantage of his God-given attributes, which is his size and his skill, and use that to your benefit. So if you got a guy like that, you got to use it. That's the bottom line. You got a guy like that, you got to find a way to get him some mismatches, some switches, some ISOs down there, and let him take advantage of those skills.
One of the other things that Budenholzer has done, and a lot of people have talked about this, is that he's got a guy at the dunker spot now. I know that's been a big part of how the offense has kind of evolved a little bit.
Yeah.
How is that creating, better shots, not just for Giannis, but, better open threes for Forbes and for Giroux and for the other guys?
So before this season, last year was five out. It was like Giannis with the basketball. You had four quadrants to it. Two at each break line and two in the corner. You had those spots filled at all times. So now defenses, especially in transition, but even half court, they're able to load up along the free throw line. So Giannis is seeing this wall, right? And that wall, Toronto, Nick Nurse did a great job kind of getting things started a couple of years ago. That's a tough, tough nut to crack. I don't care how skilled you are, if you don't have a reliable three-point shot, which Giannis doesn't, they're just waiting for you. So now with the dunker, the first guy down, and normally it just depends on who it is. Sometimes it's Brook, sometimes it's a smaller player, sometimes it's Drew Holiday.
Right.
But you're taking a defender away from the wall. You're dismantling the wall. You're changing the geometric shape of that wall out top. And with Giannis now, instead of three guys he has to beat, it's two guys. And that sounds like that could be problematic also. But trust me, with his skill level, his quickness, his ball handling ability, his elasticity at his size, he could do that relatively easy. Be two guys up top. Three guys, it's a little bit tougher.
Yeah.
And the other point about the dunker, and Giannis didn't like the dunker initially. He's like, I haven't gotten used to playing with it. It's just tough to make this adjustment after playing five out. Now he loves the dunker because, first of all, it dismantles the wall, takes a brick out of the wall, and puts it in another position. But now you've got guys in Drew Holiday, Dante DiVincenzo did this before he was injured really well. But when they would occupy the dunker, you hit them with a pass. If their guy turns his head or helps, instead of them attacking the basket from the dunker, they're kicking it out to open shooters. Now you got the defense rotating, more shifting going on,
right?
More defensive guys out. So it just changes the geometric kind of shape of the defenses that Giannis was seeing. And it's been a really, really good benefit. And the longer that this team has played it this season, the more they have learned how to play it effectively. And right now they're doing a great job of just keeping them. It might be Bryn Forbes. He'll start in the dunker, penetration come to his side. His man helps. He spaces out to that corner. Boom, hit him, three-pointer, And so it's really helped the shooters and big players alike occupying that dunker area.
How does someone like Drew, who really jumped into a team that was championship capable, how has he pulled this off in a way? Like, he seems to be so fluently a part of this group. already. How was his relationship with Giannis, and how did he do that? How did he become a leader so fast in Milwaukee?
Well, as you guys know, a lot of it is timing. When you acquire a guy, what he's been through. And so Drew has never won anything. He's bounced around from Philly to New Orleans, had all-star caliber seasons in both places, had a great playoff run against Lillard in Portland, averaged 25 a game and put the clamps on, but never won anything. And so I would even go further to say the health situation, health challenge they faced with his wife, Lauren, when she had some serious issues around child, all that stuff puts things in perspective. So when you talk about pressure, when my wife is teetering between life and death, taking a 3-point shot at the end of a basketball game to win or lose it,
right?
That pales in comparison to what I went through. So that's where he is right now. And he's always been a really, just stable, a respected type of an athlete by his peers. And so he comes into Milwaukee just wanting to win, wanting a championship, wanting to get to that next level. But his life experiences, the vastness of him, both on and off the court, I believe that puts him in, they're giving away millions of dollars to different Black-owned businesses, doing all this great philanthropic stuff. He and Lauren, all this good stuff. He's just enjoying being Drew Holiday right now. And he's on a team where he doesn't have to carry the load, but it's essential to have him out there contributing at both ends like he's so capable of doing. So it's almost like the perfect storm. And it's just his personality. He's got he's the middle brother of three great athletes in his family. And he's just got this ability to not have to be the star, not have to attract all the attention. But he'll tell you, I'm the best defensive player in the league. He'll tell you, without hesitation, how he feels about himself. But he doesn't have to go out there, and wear it and make sure everybody knows it and be disappointed or pissed off if he doesn't get the acclaim that he thinks he deserves. He's really comfortable with who he is right now. So he fits in perfectly with his team.
Man, so Marcus, I want to shift real quick. And again, the more I read about you, the more fascinated I'm about you. Everybody knows your star turn in White Man Can't Jump, right? We all know about that one. Dude, you were in Bye Bye Birdie in high school? Like,
how? Oh, yeah, you're going way back.
Oh,
yeah,
my goodness.
I was Conrad Birdie and Bye Bye Birdie. I was Little Abner. I've been doing this acting thing for a long time. Since seventh grade. I was a theater arts major at UCLA. I did, plays. And the guy that actually wrote Penitentiary, Jamal Fanaka, with Leon Kennedy.
Right.
He was a kind of a contemporary of mine at UCLA in the film school, and we had some projects that we did together. So yeah, I've been around this thing for a long time, and it's funny, White Man Can't Jump, Blue Chip, some other stuff I did. A lot of great episodic TV, LA Law, The Sinbad Show, some great shows from that era that I had some leading guest starring roles in, man, but it was a lot of fun. But, it's funny, I got to a point where it was either get a great broadcasting gig or continue to try and be this tall actor and find a starring role for a tall actor is outside of basketball films. It's not easy to do.
Yeah,
so,
right.
The broadcasting was cool. And I love it. It's easy. It's exciting. And I'm with some great people now, great organization. So, but the acting is like the passion. As a matter of fact, let me throw this out there. I've written several screenplays and so one that we're trying to get, it's over at CAA and it's getting some traction now, but it's about integrating the LA Fire Department in the 1950s, this courageous group of Black men called the Stentorians.
Okay.
We interviewed several of them when they were in their 90s, Todd Wasserman, my writing partner and I, and wrote a great screenplay that getting some traction right now. But the other thing I just finished, and dear, you'll appreciate this. I just finished writing a screenplay about the life of Reggie Harding.
I'm so glad you brought him up, because that's the character. That's what's in White Man Can't Jump. It's based off of Reggie Harding, right?
Based on that character, he's a guy in Detroit that went to the liquor store at 7 feet tall and tried to rob it. And the guy was like, come on, Reggie. I know that's you. And Reggie supposedly said, this ain't me.
Right.
That was the first story. One of the first stories you heard as a player. So it piqued my interest. I did a voluminous amount of research on him over the last year, and in the process, D, I got to be friends with Ray Scott, the former coach of the year with the Pistons in the mid-70s. We still keep in contact today. Dave Bing.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, Oliver Darden. I mean, all these who was a teammate of Kazee Russell's at Michigan, who played with Reggie in Indiana. Rob Thorne gave me some great stories about Reggie when they were teammates in the old ABA.
Yeah.
Actually, it was early NBA. I think it was Chicago where they played together. But this character, I mean, but Reggie Harding, not character, but this man, I mean, with this story was one of those, you know, tragic stories. And, you know, anyway, but he wound up getting shot and killed at like 30 years old on the streets of Detroit. The siren of the streets was always the thing that held him back. He dropped 23-19 on Bill Russell. He called out Wilt Chamberlain from the sidelines one game, like, "You're not the big man, I'm the big man." His life was so colorful that it had to be like memorialized on the page. And I was able to put together something on him. And so anyway, I'm in the process now trying to move that forward and see what I can do with it. But just the experience of learning about him and the heroin addiction and everything he went through, man, was I think something that that would be, you know, good for young people to see. We don't always need to have the Pollyannish kind of, you know, great, you know, inspirational stories, but those stories where we can see somebody who didn't have the positive mentorship and role models in his life and where that could lead also. So that's what that's about.
You know, if you need a really good writer, especially somebody to bring some color to it, I think you know somebody. I was gonna say Josiah. What makes you most proud? Your son's basketball career, or that he's become the funniest person on the internet?
It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable.
Like, he is incredible, yo. It's unbelievable. Yes. Every time
he's how quick he is with stuff.
It's unbelievable. It's how good he is.
Yeah, he cranks it out, doesn't he? He gets it out there. No, obviously it's, and not only so he created and wrote for Legends of Chamberlain Heights. They ran for 2 years on Comedy Central.
Yeah.
Really good animated series, kind of ahead of its time with some of its themes and subject matter. But he also, Ava DuVernay, When They See Us fame, Central Park 5, she's doing a thing or did a thing on Colin Kaepernick that's going to be on one of the streaming stations soon. And Josiah wrote an episode or two with her for that, worked on that extensively. He's working with her on some other stuff that she's got going. So he's working with Ava DuVernay. And so that's, you know, something a lot of people don't know, but that's definitely a feather in the cap. We've also written something together on growing up in this area of Los Angeles near Baldwin Hills called View Park. And it's based on my life loosely. But it's one of those situations where you guys appreciate this. We moved up to this area when I was 11 years old, 1967. I'm playing after school league football, just a pickup sandlot game. I'm playing quarterback. It's a true story. And my right end is Ray Charles Jr. And my left end is Ike Turner Jr. That's the kind of people that I'm growing up with in this neighborhood. Doctors, lawyers, swimming pools, and movie stars, Beverly Hillbillies, you know, that whole existence. And so we put together something on kind of, you know, the things that are happening in this neighborhood over the years and gentrification and all that good stuff. And so we'll see where it goes with that. It's getting a little traction also. But Josiah, his writing, his creativity is it's funny. When his show got canceled, Legends of Chamberlain Heights, after 2 years because of lack of promotion, he was a little despondent about that. I told him, look, man, that's not the last great creative idea you're going to have. You know, that's just the stepping stone that's going to lead to bigger and better things. And so far it has.
I was wondering, can you afford him now at this point? He writes for Ava.
Not at all. Trust me. He lets me know it every time I talk, whenever I talk to him, too.
You don't get no family discount?
No. He's great at that, though. No, we always bounce stuff off each other. And, you know, he trusts me. I trust him. And he always, you know, he always pumps me up like, yeah, Dad, you're like the best writer I know. I'm like, yeah, okay, thanks. Just stay at it. Stay with it, man. Don't keep me, you know, just be confident. Stay with it. Don't lose confidence in what you're doing. So he's great in terms of just pumping me up, man. So I love him to death.
Man, so along those lines, man, I can't keep you forever. I'd love to, but I know you got stuff to do. The whole process of writing, and this is something that I'm fascinated about, because you were in the public eye for 30 years, right? 35 years, you know, back from the days at UCLA with John Wooden, winning the last national championship team that John Wooden won, through your playing career, through your acting career. And I'm always curious how people who have been in the public eye, who have been interviewed, then turn around or are able to kind of be creative themselves, because there's always this kind of feeling from a lot of people when you talk to them, you misquoted me, or not even that you misquoted me, but you got the tone wrong. You got the sense of what I was trying to say wrong. And I just wonder what it's like when you're trying to be that creative person and come up with, you know, a dialogue and stories and things like that from the creative side, as opposed to kind of the day-to-day journalistic side that you were a part of, that you've been a part of most of your adult life.
Well, and that's a great question, Dave. And I think because of that, it gives a person like myself a real, a sensibility and a sensitiveness to making sure that I pay due respect to whatever subject matter that I'm approaching. You know what I'm saying? You got to tell the truth. You can't sugarcoat some of the stuff that like a guy like a Reggie Harding and the heroin abuse and all that.
Right.
There's always the backstory. So Reggie Harding, his mom had him when she was 16. She gave him to a foster family in Detroit, and some of the treatment that he got through that foster care wasn't the best. And he was sent to a cherry picking farm after winning the city championship when he was 17 for a whole summer because of some of his, you know. So you look at some of the backstories with people like that, and you try and explain as much as explain, but not excuse, paths or behaviors they may have taken in life. And that's, to me, is the interesting part when you get the full picture of what a guy's life has been about. And so that's what I've learned from that experience, DA, is just as long as writers are fair and make an attempt to find out the whole story and don't try and put their own particular professional spin on it. A lot of guys, as you know, that interview, they've already got the story made up in their mind that they want to write. So they asked you stuff specifically to that point. And
prove
which is
my
fine.
Thesis.
I mean,
prove my thesis.
Well, David, you're one of the best at it. In some of our interviews on Zoom, when you're talking to Budenholzer or whomever, Giannis, whomever it happens to be, then I read your piece in The Athletic or wherever it happens to be. I understand what your process was about, but you're just kind of filling in some of the blanks. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
A lot of guys want to have this narrative. A lot of writers want to have this particular narrative about how they want a story to go. And if things happen to go a different direction than what they had planned, they'll just ignore that different direction and continue on with whatever particular narrative path that they had established at the beginning.
So it sounds like you're saying that I could send you my work for some,
on spec. You send it to him on spec, Mark.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. But I may have to sprinkle a little mama's home cooking on it.
Oh, Lord.
I start thinking about Sacramento and Matt Barnes and Liberty Choir and Kamari Brown. That's how my mind works, man. So, that's how we do it.
Mama's cooking, baby. Mama's cooking.
We could do a whole Last Dance type of thing on Kwame, man. I mean, I actually think Kwame's made some good points in some of this,
He's made some great points. This brother here has made some great points, trust me. Some of it's a little out of left field, but I mean, he's... What's interesting is that I never really heard him articulate any of his inner feelings about anything ever.
Yeah.
And then to hear him actually
speak. And then
speak,
it's like a flood, right? tidal wave of feelings.
But it's like D.A. says, a lot of it, I mean, he talks about kind of the one and dones and how they were trying to put a lid on that. So they had to not, give a lot of the guys. Kwame scored 17 and 7, I believe, in the McDonald's game. That included, I think, Tyson Chandler, Eddie sure. Kerr, whoever it was in that game. He was the best player in that game. It wasn't like drafting him number one was this big reach. Yeah. He was the best player in that game. Now, you can debate his career from that point on all you want, positives and negatives.
Yeah.
But in that game, he was the best player and had me thinking he was going to turn out to be one hell of a pro. So for whatever reason, maybe it didn't happen. But, you can't fault MJ or whomever for looking at that game and thinking that this guy was going to be really, really good.
Yeah. No, I mean, look, Kwame, first of all, Kwame had a career. You know what I'm saying? Like you can debate the career, but he had one at least, which is more than a lot of guys, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, no, there's no doubt. And even when he was with Washington, I remember very well his second year, they played at the Bulls, I'm pretty sure. And he gave Tyson the business in that game. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It just, for whatever, you know, there's a lot of reasons. I don't think it was all MJ's fault. I don't think it was all Kwame's fault. It was just, you know, bad timing, circumstance.
Right.
You know, it just didn't work out in Washington.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it just didn't work out in Washington. But I remember distinctly people in the organization telling me before the draft that they really, one thing that really impressed them about Kwame was, I remember someone telling me this, like, he would, after the varsity game, he played at Glenn Academy, I think, in Georgia. He would go watch the women's team play or go watch the JV team play and be their biggest cheerer, biggest advocate, you know. So he wasn't acting like a star that wasn't interested in anybody else. Like he really cared about the other people that played at that school and how impressed they were with that, you know, like.
Yeah.
I mean. And you know what? And the bottom line is, people have been dumping on this guy for 20 years. He's entitled to clap back. That's what I've been telling people. You know what I mean? He's entitled to clap back. You know, it's okay. You know, he's entitled to say this is what I think, and you know, whatever. You know, like I said, he's made some decent points. So
yeah, I agree.
Anyway, man, look. Marcus, this has been great. I swear to God, this has been fantastic.
Oh yeah, incredible.
You know,
but hold on before you go. Yeah. I saw you dunked on your birthday.
Yes.
What was the recovery after that?
Oh man, it wasn't as bad as one might think in 65. But Josiah is the one that got me doing that 10 years ago when Blake Griffin jumped over the Kia, whatever it was, but. It's funny, he was on his way over to shoot the dunk, and I went in the backyard to try and do it, and the first three or four times, I could barely get the ball to touch the rim, and finally, by the time he got here, I got a little warmed up, and you know what I mean? I didn't know if I could do it, and I finally wound up doing it a couple of times, and it was cool, but I'm just doing it, man, just, you know, for no other reason than to give me an impetus to stay in shape during the year between the dunks that I do on my birthday, and just to see how long it lasts, and when it's over, it'll be over, and I won't be no love lost. You know what I mean? It'd be all good that it lasted as long as it did. So, yeah.
Man. Well, look, man,
it's dope. I love it.
Yeah, continued success, man. You know, we'd love to have you on again and again, man. This has been great, and just, you know, I love learning, and you're a great teacher. So, man, thank you for joining us. Seriously,
thanks. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Great. Thank you.
It is great.
Have a good
thank
one,
you.
Man. So, yeah, Mark, I tell you what, man, I love, you know, his Twitter account handle is Elder.
Old school, baby.
Elder, old school, and Elder Marcus Thompson. And that's, I love listening to the elders, you know, who have been through it and done it well and done it at a high level. And we can learn from them if we stop and listen. So, man, that was awesome. That was awesome.
Oh yeah, he's built from us. You know what I'm saying? This is that Cali bread. You know, this is how we do, DA. You know, hey, DC's got an incredible hoop legacy. Dare I say, slept on hoop legacy.
Well,
right?
not by us.
but I do think, you know, you hear a lot about New York and LA. I mean, people sleep on DC though.
Yeah, real well, talk,
like,
you know,
people sleep on. But we still got one too out here in Cali. You know, we got some hoopers.
You got a few.
We got a few. I'm claiming them LA ones, you know.
You can't claim the LA ones. You got to just stick with the Bay.
I can't.
Just stick with the Bay. The Bay is good enough.
We Cali, man.
Come on, man. You can stick with Oakland.
I'm claiming all that. Now, when we beefing with LA, then I'll just go Oakland. I'm like, then it's got to be like per capita or something, you know? We got to switch it up because it ain't fair.
Right. Oh, man.
With all the people down there.
All right, y'all. Well, look, listen, leave that 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iTunes, wherever you hear this show, man. And if you leave something less than a 5-star review, keep that to yourself. All right.